Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good Monday morning, everyone. When it was published 40 years ago, Francis Moore-Lappé's book, Diet for a Small Planet, was the first major work on environmentally friendly eating, which sought to change the way consumers think about where their meals come from. Books like Fast Food Nation and The Omnivore's Dilemma and many others have followed in its footsteps, and so has Diet for a Hot Planet, a book by Lappé's daughter, Anna. And now Francis Moore-Lappé is the author of EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. She lays out seven messages which she says keep us from finally finding a solution to the environmental crisis, and argues that the real challenge is a feeling of hopelessness, one which occupies our attitudes toward democracy and our government, as well as to our planet. Joining me now are both Lappés, Francis Moore and Anna. They are founding principals together of the Small Planet Institute and Environmental Awareness Network. Welcome both of you to WNYC. Welcome back, both of you, but the first time together.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And Anna, so tell us what it was like, first of all, politically, nutritionally, growing up with Frances Moore-Lappé as your mom.
Well, I guess you never know what it would be like to grow up with someone else's mother. So, certainly I was the kind of test child of the Diet for a Small Planet diet. And seeing as I'm at the very end of my second very healthy pregnancy, I feel like I have I'm proof that this kind of diet, that whole foods, real foods diet that is increasingly in vogue, is really a healthy way to raise your kids.
Frances, what were you putting on the plate when Anna was 7 years old?
Well, pretty much what Anna and I eat today, which is, very strong in we call it the plant and planet-friendly diet. It's very strong in whole, as Anna said, whole grains, beans and nuts and seeds and all these wonderful other sources of protein. Very strong in fresh produce and both fruits and vegetables. What can I say? It's the way that human beings have eaten until quite recently, until what we call this radical experiment in which we are now the guinea pigs and not faring well.
And Anna, did you grow up with this idea of the eco-mind, to quote the title of your mom's new book?
Sure. And I think that, as bordering on cheesy as this might sound, I think that with both my parents, not only did they kind of think consciously about what food they put into my body, but what ideas they put into my mind as well. And that I was very much raised with this approach to the world of asking questions and not accepting what is as what is. And so much of my mother's message in EcoMind is that the extent to which we don't do that, the extent to which we don't see the possibilities is the extent to which we're holding ourselves back from really being able to solve our worst environmental and health crises.
And we're going to go through some of those seven psychological, not just policy barriers, but psychological barriers. And it's funny because conservatives often say that environmentalists are too pessimistic.
Right.
And now Francis Moore-Lappé has written a book kind of saying the same thing. But before we get to that, Francis, Anna's previous book is Diet for a Hot Planet, The Climate Crisis at the End of Your Fork and What You Can Do About It, which built on your work. So do you think generationally that she has pushed your ideas further by bringing global warming into it? Because that's not what anybody was talking about in the 1970s.
True. Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Just couldn't be more thrilled and, of course, proud that she has written this brilliant book and that so many people now are making that central connection to the primary role that our food system plays in the climate crisis. And so I just couldn't be more thrilled that she is bringing forth this message.
Is it too convenient that, the big environmental issues that people were talking about in the 70s, other kinds of sustainability, like, Diet for a Small Planet emphasized that there was a lot of hunger in the world because it takes so much land to grow the grains that feed the cows that give us our meat. And if we didn't eat so much meat, we could use that grain to feed more human beings. And that was, I think, a lot of the political message behind Diet for a Small Planet. Now you're talking about global warming. Does the same set of agricultural choices also inform this very different problem?
Right. Well, and it's really, and this goes back to that sort of eco-mind question, it's really about how we frame what this crisis is. What is the food crisis? And this is something my mother was saying 40 years ago, and I feel I'm echoing in this latest work, but that so often we hear the food crisis framed as a production crisis. Well, if only we could produce more food, then we would have no hunger in the world. What she was saying 40 years ago and what is still true today is that actually the crisis that we're faced with when it comes to this incredible extent of hunger that's still almost a billion people, it's really a symptom of a crisis of democracy, a symptom of a crisis of power, and it's a symptom of our not being able to respond to the fact that this industrial agricultural system is really at the heart of so many of our environmental crises, including, as I say in my most recent work, including the climate crisis.
By the way, Frances, I know Diet for a Small Planet was not a diet book in the conventional sense, but did you ever get feedback that people who really followed the book's recommendations wound up with a weight problem because people thought, okay, I'm a vegetarian now. It's fine to load up on the carbs. I'm going to have all this pasta and I'm going to have all this rice because it's good for the planet and good for me.
Oh, no, just the opposite. I think as we eat, certainly in my case and so many people I know, that as we move toward a plant-centered diet that's really whole foods, that our bodies are so satisfied that our weight, we crave less and our bodies come into balance with what they really thrive best on. So and certainly in many people's case, in my case, my weight actually decreased to what I wanted it to be, and it stayed ever since, that same thing. But I want to go back to what Anna is saying here because it's so important, and she said it, but I want to underscore that Diet for a Small Planet, I was trying to help people see that, in fact, we created an economic system that was manufacturing hunger because that such inequality existed in the world and continued to exist so that people can't make a direct demand on what the world produces. And therefore, we had this mass, and still do, of relatively cheap grain that's cheap enough that it makes sense to feed it to livestock. And so over a third of the world's grain is going to livestock. In fact, only a half of the world's grain reaches people directly. So I was trying even then to focus people on the sort of the assumptions and the rules of our economic system, that if we don't question those, we'll end up creating scarcity for many, the experience of scarcity, no matter how much we produce, because we're now producing more food per person than we did when I wrote Diet for a Small Planet, and yet we have, you know, many, many more hungry people.
My guests on WNYC, two generations of Lepays, Frances Moore and Anna, both food and environmental activists. Frances's new book is called EcoMind, Changing the Way We Think to Create the World We Want. We can take a few phone calls. Anybody out there, perhaps a two-generation of Lepays fan or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And in the new book, Frances, I want to acknowledge the fact that there are seven so-called thought traps that you write about, that are of the mind, eco-mind, changing the way we think to create the world we want. And I'm going to run down the seven real quick. This is the real thumbnail version. One, we must shift to no-growth economies since growth destroys the planet. You don't agree with that statement. Two, market demand and a growing population drive endless exploitation of the earth. Again, these are the traps that you think environmentalists fall into. Three, the thought that we've had it too good. We must power down and to learn to live within the earth's limits. Four, humans are greedy and selfish. We have to overcome these aspects to survive. Five, we have to coerce people to do the right thing. Six, we have to become so disconnected from nature that it's hopeless. And seven, it's too late, democracy has failed, and so has environmentalism. And that's such a provocative list, because I think it is some, you know, it includes some of the core things that environmentalists believe, such as that we must shift to no-growth economies since growth destroys the planet. You don't believe that?
I think what we're doing is not growing, we're destroying. And so to call what we're doing a growth economy when its essence is waste and destruction is really misleading, and it doesn't empower us. So all of these reframes that I do in the book, it's not about becoming more positive in a way, but rather becoming more powerful, to see the power we have. And so these messages, I believe, take away our power. So this one, the idea that we're growing now and we've got to slow down, first of all, it doesn't address the suffering of the people who now are shut out of the economy, who are jobless. What do we say to them? This message does not work for them. But on a deeper level, as I say, it blesses what we're currently doing with a very positive word that is growth. You know, I want my flowers to grow and my grandbabies to grow. So
we can grow the economy without despoiling the earth and causing more hunger, is what you're saying.
Yes, because what we're doing now, just consider this, Brian, that estimates of scientists are that we are wasting from 55 to 87% of the energy in the United States, you know, and that as far as food, we've already begun to talk about that waste. So this is vast, the waste built in. So how do we create economies that are not, that are, you know, that are actually providing the real needs that we have aligned with the natural laws, rather than disrupting nature. That's the key.
And Anna, I'm going to give you number three from your mom's list, that we've had it too good. We must power down and learn to live within the Earth's limits.
Right.
Isn't that a core environmental belief? That we in this country, anyway, have had it too good in terms of high-impact consumerism, and we must power down?
Well, again, this goes back to what she was just saying with the other one as well, that, you know, for so many people, people haven't been having it too good. You know, they don't feel like they've been able, in the case of the 15% of Americans who are now on food stamps, they wouldn't say, oh, we have it too good, we're able to feed our families well. No, they're struggling. And so so the point is, again, to look at actually moving toward these more sustainable systems when it comes to food, more ecological systems, that we're really talking about truly bringing goodness to people, truly being able to have people nourish themselves with food that is actually helping them thrive, as opposed to giving them diabetes or giving them other diet-related illnesses.
Or, Brian, an additional way of saying this is that this frame of we've hit the limits, the message, oh, we've hit the limits, we must cut back, we've had it too good. Well, that can blind us. For example, the plastic that is now creating a plastic soup, some call it, this huge patch in the Pacific Ocean that's size of two states of Texas. Okay, we could cut back. Oh, we could cut back by 50%. We still have a huge patch of plastic the size of one state of Texas. That's still not getting us there. So we have to really rethink in terms of what are the systems that need to be changed, and why is it that we are creating together a world that none of us as individuals would choose? That's really the core question that this book addresses.
Let me get a caller or two in for you before we run out of time. Richard on Long Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, hi. I like some of the ideas that I hear, and I haven't read the book, and I'm not sure, but the last thing you said really kind of resonates, which is that, you know, why are we not getting to where we want to be? And I'm afraid that a lot of these books, they come out with great ideas, and, you know, people can be vegetarian. They come out with ideas that we've heard before, but for some reason, they don't stick. They're, you know, over the years, we just keep going in the same direction, and whether... My question is whether it's just really hopeless to try to reform these systems without a much more fundamental kind of revolutionary shift, like the Occupy Wall Street, for instance, or some of the more, you know, classic ideological alternative mm-hmm. systems would provide. But what you just said about why we're not getting there, you know, I'd love to hear the answer to that.
Richard, thank you very much. And he talks about Occupy Wall Street. Anna, I know you run a blog on smallplanet.org. And you post a lot about movements around the country, including what you call Occupy Big Food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually was just in Zuccotti Park yesterday with my daughter for the Occupy Farmers March, where hundreds of farmers and allies marched to Zuccotti Park for Big Seed Swap. But the message is really that, and I think this caller really points to, I think, a really key question, which is how do we take these ideas and really make them transformative in the real world? And while I think in a lot of ways things have gotten worse in the 40 years since my mother wrote Diet for Small planet. There's more hunger. There's more of an ecological crisis. There's also this incredible movement that's emerged across the country and that I saw yesterday in Zuccotti Park that's pointing at this similarity between the two movements about the growing inequality in the food system.
Can I say, because you've said it twice, I thought there's less hunger than there was 30 years ago. I thought 30, 40 years ago, the UN used to talk about 40,000 babies a day dying from malnutrition-related causes, and now they say that's cut in half.
No, no, no. Overall, there are now close to 1 billion people hungry. That's well over a million more than we had, you know, 5 years ago. So clearly the number has grown radically because not a lack of production. Actually, we've had some record world harvests, but because a price crisis in food, which is in part driven by agrofuel production, in part driven by massive increase in speculation in commodities and other issues. But I want to go back to the caller. I love this question. This is foundational. So that's why, you know, at the end of the book, I address the thought trap, it's too late. And I basically say, just as he's saying, we have to go to the systems, and this is what Occupy Movement is about, that we have to have a real democracy. I call it a living democracy, one accountable to us, and that means getting money out of the system. I call what we have now privately held government, and what we need is government accountable to citizens, and that involves a campaign successful, and we know how to do this to get money out of the system.
I want to thank two generations of La Paz, Francis Moore and Anna. Francis's new book is called Eco Mind, and there is an event coming up, the 10th Annual Small Planet Fund Party and Auction this Friday, and you can go to our website for more information on that event this Friday here in New York. Anna?
Absolutely, in a top-secret location. You have to get a ticket to find out where, but you'll get to celebrate all these great success stories with us.
Well, thank you both very, very much. It's been great, and I see that there is a third generation by looking at you and not too far off. So we'll see what kind of activism that person may be back with in 20 or 30 years. Thank you both so much.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, Brian.